In politics, people often tell you not to get lost in the weeds. The Weeds from Vox is a podcast for people who love the weeds, because that's where politics becomes policy, the stuff that shapes your life and the lives of the people you care about. Every week, Matthew Iglesias is joined by a variety of leading Vox voices and policy experts to dig into the weeds on critical issues. It's a podcast if you want to get lost in the weeds, or if you just want to keep current with politics. Subscribe to The Weeds for free right now in your favorite podcast app to get new episodes automatically from Vox and the Vox Media Podcast Network. Belarusians rising up against their president of 26 years. Next door in Russia, Vladimir Putin does not like what he's seeing.
Because he doesn't want Belarus to set an example, to set precedent for Russia, where Mr. Putin's been in power for 20 years.
Also, Latinos fighting for a museum of their own in Washington.
We read about Sonia Sotomayor, you know, but who else is out there? I'm sure there's many more.
And Taiwan's digital minister has some really crucial life hacks. So let me get that straight. You can sterilize a medical mask in a rice cooker?
Yeah, in traditional rice cooker. That's exactly right. See my Twitter for how.
Her Twitter feed is also full of the ways Taiwan uses technology to manage the pandemic. I'm Marco Werman. Those stories and much more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. It is good to be with you again. 8 months feels like an eternity when you're living through a pandemic. But for scientists researching immunity to a new virus, 8 months goes by in a flash. Some of the first studies on how immune we are to COVID-19 are starting to come out, offering a glimpse into how protected people might remain after being infected. Marion Pepper is a researcher at the University of Washington specializing in immunology. Marion, a lot of people might have heard a misleading news story over the weekend that people who've had COVID-19 are immune from getting reinfected for a certain period of time. Clarify this. What do we actually know about immunity right now?
Right now, we have done studies that have looked at how the body responds to infection and whether people have the right pieces in place to be protected from a reinfection. There isn't really any information yet about how long that immunity will last. Some of this came from some guidelines from the CDC that came out that were later clarified. We have looked so far to see that there will be some type of immunity, but we can't say for sure.
So I know you've got a new study that's going through the peer review process now. What did you find out about immunity?
I think the good news that we have to share is that the immune response in people who have experienced what we consider to be mild COVID-19, meaning they weren't hospitalized, looks very normal. It looks like what we would expect from a good immune response to a virus. All the components, all the pieces that you need to be protected from reinfection look to be there. It doesn't prove it, but it suggests that these people will be protected from a reinfection.
So help us understand what that is all about, because I know your study looked at blood from people who had mild cases of COVID, not the individuals themselves. What are the limitations of studies like yours that look at immunity in a lab as opposed to out in the real world?
There are two ways to really test immunity. Of course, the most obvious way to do it would be to know that people have been reinfected who have had it before and to show that they're not getting reinfected. But that's really hard to do. So what we did instead is looked in the blood of people who had had COVID-19 and looked at their cells specifically that can respond to the virus to see how many are there, what they looked like, and how they functioned to our best ability in the lab. And they showed that these cells not only are there, but they look like they should be a functional population of cells that could fight this infection.
So what are the hardest parts of studying immunity in the coronavirus? Like, where does the nuance come in?
It's hard because it takes time for immunity to develop. So you need to wait until an infection has been cleared. So it takes time to be able to say for sure that the cells are still there that we would like to see that would be protective.
I'm guessing a lot of people hearing this ultimately want to know, when can I start walking around without a mask?
No one should be walking around without a mask. It's critically important that people still wear masks and social distance and take the right precautions not to get this.
Yeah, so just explain that a little more. People who may be immune, I mean, they should be wearing a mask too, right? Because we just don't know who really is immune.
Yes. All we can say is that the right cells that look like they're going to be protective and to help you be immune are there. We can't say for sure that people are going to be immune.
So do we know if people who have had the coronavirus have gotten it again?
I don't know of any evidence showing that a person has been reinfected, but those cases may be out there. I just don't know of them.
So what is your advice to people who are confused about all the messaging coming out about immunity? Because there does seem to be a lot of messaging and a lot of almost contradictory advice.
I think the message is that this study that we did is hopeful. And I think we're optimistic that the vast majority of people who have had COVID-19, who have mild symptoms, should have some sort of immunity that should last for some time. We can't say how long, but this is actually very encouraging news for the vast majority of people who have had it.
And yet you're telling people to keep the masks on. So there's a lot
Absolutely.
We don't know.
There's still a lot we don't know, and there is no way to predict who is going to be immune versus who isn't going to be immune at this point. If everyone wears a mask, then we can reduce transmission and get beyond this pandemic.
Marianne Pepper is an immunologist at the University of Washington. Thanks very much for being with us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
New Zealand has been a model for how to deal with the coronavirus, 1,600 cases total. But now it's fighting a cluster, around 80 active cases. So New Zealand has extended its lockdown, and the Prime Minister, Jacinda Ardern, has announced another protective measure, delaying elections. The World's Sarah Birnbaum reports.
The new date for the election will be October 17th, a delay of 1 month. Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern said that will give political parties enough time to campaign.
For the Electoral Commission to prepare, and for voters to feel assured of a safe, accessible, and credible election.
The delay in New Zealand might remind you of something closer to home.
I don't want to delay. I want to have the election. But I also don't want to have to wait for 3 months and then find out that the ballots are all missing and the election doesn't mean anything.
On July 30th, President Trump suggested on Twitter that we delay the election here in the U.S. The reason, he said, was that with all the mail-in voting because of COVID, the election would be, quote, the most inaccurate and fraudulent election in history. He's offered no proof to substantiate that claim, though. There are lots of differences between what's happening in New Zealand and what happened here, says Tufts University political scientist Jeff Berry. For starters,
two very different systems.
New Zealand is a parliamentary system. That means elections can be called at any time, and the prime minister has the sole authority to call the election.
So she's well within what's sort of normal New Zealand politics.
Whereas in the United States,
our constitution tells us when presidential elections are, first Tuesday after the first Monday in November.
Another difference between here and New Zealand, one word, consensus. Before Ardern made the announcement, she consulted all the political parties.
I did canvass widely. I canvassed everyone. Not everyone was of the same view, but I gave equal weight and equal measure to everyone's view.
But in the U.S., Jeff Berry says the situation was very different.
President Trump just said what he wanted to say. He didn't consult the Republican leadership in the Congress, much less the Democrats.
And then there are the approval ratings. Jacinda Ardern's approval ratings last month were hovering around 65%. She's New Zealand's most popular prime minister in a century. Trump's approval ratings, on the other hand, are 42%, according to the latest Gallup poll.
The president is way behind in the polls, and this was very transparent as a move to try to shake things up in the presidential race.
It didn't work, and he had to back off the suggestion to move the election. But it still stoked fears that Trump would do anything to hold on to power. So the moral? Delaying the election can be seen either as an appropriate measure to protect the public health or as a power grab to circumvent a democratic system. Depends on your vantage point. For The World, I'm Sarah Birnbaum.
Getting exam results this year was never going to be straightforward. How do you grade students who have not been to school for months and haven't even sat for exams? Teenagers in Britain and across Europe are discovering that it's complicated and they're not happy. The British government found itself in the line of fire after nearly 40% of students in their final year of high school, or secondary school as it's called there, received lower grades than expected. At the heart of the issue is a computer algorithm, one that students and teachers say is fundamentally flawed. Our Europe correspondent Orla Barry joins us. So how exactly were students being graded?
Well, in the UK, and it's different in different parts of Europe, Marco, students were graded based on a couple of factors. The teacher's assessment of what they thought the student would get in their exams, and then the overall results from the school in previous years was also taken into account. So this is where the algorithm comes in, because the exams regulator in the UK was worried that the teacher's assessment would be somewhat biased, that they would inflate the results this year, particularly because it's been such a tough year for students. And they instead said they would take into account how the school had done in previous years and built an algorithm around that. The difficulty is, when the results came out, 39% of students received a lower grade than what their own teachers had predicted. And the majority of those students were attending state schools, in many cases in quite disadvantaged areas. But the students from private schools actually saw their grades going up. So it's led to accusations that the algorithm is basically flawed and it's favoured those who attended private fee-paying schools.
So what's been the reaction among final year students to all of this?
Well, as you can imagine, many of them are very upset. There's been protests outside Westminster, outside the Houses of Parliament for the last few days. Hundreds of students have taken to the streets giving out about it and calling for the Education Secretary, Gavin Williamson, to resign. I spoke to one student a little earlier. She's Lois Best from North Devon in England. And her plan was to study anthropology at university, but her grades are downgraded to such an extent that she's set to lose her college place. So I asked her how she had felt when she saw her results.
I was just so shocked at first that I didn't know what to think. I thought it might have been a mistake. And then the following few days, I just cried a lot. And it's only been really today that I've actually started to feel quite frustrated and angry about what's happened. So it was so clear, especially in the area that I live in, that this was definitely classism, because all of my friends, they were all set to achieve really highly and they've also been downgraded. So this definitely wasn't a coincidence.
Yeah, I mean, pictures of the student protests this weekend in London suggest a lot of anger of this. As you say, it differs from one country to another. I gather this algorithm, though, isn't just being used in the UK.
No, and all countries did take a different approach to exams this year. In Germany, actually, they did sit their exams, whereas in France, they based it on continuous assessment during the year. But many students internationally, including in the US, undertake the International Baccalaureate, or IB, which is often called, and essentially it's a high school program that's used by universities for college admissions, and around 150 countries around the world take these exam results. The IB exam used an algorithm similar to the UK, where they looked at the history of the college and the historical results of that college. And Human Rights Watch has been looking at the IB results because, again, many students came out and said they were very unhappy with the grades. And children's rights researcher Hai Chong Hun has been looking at that. And she said to me what she is witnessing sounds very similar to what's happened to students in Britain.
So with the algorithm, what happened was that it downgraded many students significantly and in ways that students or their teachers were very shocked, because they really didn't reflect students' performance over the 2 years. And as a result, they did lose their university offers and their scholarships. And for any university they applied to, they ended up losing everything.
It seems, Orla, today the UK government may be having a change of heart on this.
Yes, indeed, Marco. For days, the government dug their heels in on this and said there was going to be no U-turn. And then this afternoon, Ofqual, which is the government department that regulates exams here, its chair, Roger Taylor, came out and said they were ditching the algorithm and accepting the teachers' grades. And on that, Marco, can I also say the IB body, the International Baccalaureate body, also came out today and said they're changing their system. They're ditching the algorithm and they've asked students to check what the results are, because apparently 24% of its grades are now going to be changed as a result of this.
Another serious consequence of life during the pandemic. The World's Europe correspondent Orla Barry in London. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with the world. This month's massive explosion in Beirut reminded many there of another devastating blast that rocked the Lebanese capital 15 years ago. In February of 2005, a powerful truck bomb exploded as a motorcade carrying then-Lebanese Prime Minister Rafik Hariri drove along the seafront in Beirut. The bomb tore through Hariri's vehicle, killing the Prime Minister and 21 other people. The explosion left a massive crater and tore the facades off of surrounding buildings. Tomorrow, more than 15 years later, verdicts are finally expected to be handed down at a UN-backed tribunal in the Netherlands. It's been a long time coming, considering just hours after the blast in 2005, the UN Secretary General at the time, Kofi Annan, said justice would be served.
We still do not know who did it, but I think I trust every effort will be made to identify the perpetrators, and they should be brought to justice.
President George W. Bush supported these international efforts.
We support the international investigation that will be going on to determine the killers of Mr. Hariri.
The UN's investigation into Hariri's killing has focused on the militant organization Hezbollah. On Friday, the group's leader, Hassan Nasrallah, said he is not concerned with the tribunal's decision. For us, it will be as if no decision was ever announced, he said. If our brothers are unjustly sentenced, as we expect, we will maintain their innocence. Even if convicted, the four defendants on trial are unlikely to serve prison time. They have never been detained, despite international arrest warrants. Whatever the court decides, many in Lebanon are worried that any verdict could spark renewed violence there between supporters of Hezbollah and the assassinated prime minister. We'll be following the court, its verdict, and the aftermath here at The World. Stay tuned. There are dozens of museums in Washington, D.C. Not one is dedicated to the lives and culture of Latin America. But as The World's Bianca Hillier reports, that could soon change.
Jessica Morales was born and raised in Washington, D.C. There, at her elementary school, her teachers taught her about who she was and where she came from.
I had amazing teachers that told me, you are Latina and you need to be proud of that.
Decades later, it's now Jessica who's teaching the next generation. She's the principal at D.C.'s Bancroft Elementary, just a couple miles from the school she attended as a kid, and has been there for 18 years.
One thing that I instill in all of our students is identity. Don't reject being Latino. That's an asset. It's important for them to understand, like, you are special because you are Latin American.
Latin American students make up 64% of Bancroft Elementary. But Jessica says a student's sense of identity can only grow so much within the confines of a classroom's four walls, which is why she's so excited about this recent news.
There could soon be a special showcase of Latino history, art, and culture in the nation's capital.
In July, by unanimous voice vote, the House of Representatives passed legislation to create a national Latino museum.
And El Museo is one step closer to becoming a reality.
This single step is a major victory in a fight that began back in 1994, when the Smithsonian Institution published a report looking at their own patterns of excluding Latino voices and stories. The title of the report is telling.
It was called Willful Neglect.
That's former Congresswoman Ileana Ross-Lehtinen, a Republican who represented Florida for three decades. In 1989, she became the first Latina elected to Congress. And in 1994, she was paying attention to that Smithsonian report.
What it concluded is that the Smithsonian, and I'll quote this, almost entirely excludes and ignores Latinos in nearly every aspect of its operations. Wow.
Since then, former Congresswoman Ross-Lehtinen and her colleagues across the aisle have been on a mission to build support for the museum. Celebrities such as Eva Longoria Parker and Emilio Estevan have lent their time.
We're all committed to work so hard to leave a legacy that's definitely going to last forever and that we can recognize all the hard work of Latinos.
And the bill that just passed through the House was approved with an impressive 295 co-sponsors. It had so much bipartisan support that many wonder, what's taken so long?
That is a question that we are asking ourselves a lot. What is happening? Why is it that this has been so difficult?
Ross-Lehtinen said it could be that other projects had more political clout, a better standing with the Smithsonian, or with members of Congress. She's been patient, Now, she's thrilled.
Boom, we passed it in the House.
But the fight is far from over.
Now comes the struggle to pass it in the Senate. That's a little more difficult because of COVID.
Managing COVID-19 relief efforts has created a crammed legislative calendar in the Senate. But Ross Leighton believes the Senate will eventually give the go-ahead. Then the president has to sign off. Then money has to be raised, part of which will come from taxpayers and part of which will be private donations. Then the museum has to be designed, built, and curated. So don't expect anyone to break ground next year. But when it does open, Jessica Morales, the principal at DC's Bancroft Elementary, said she'll be happy with the name on the door.
I'm glad that they're calling it the National American Latino Museum and not the National American Hispanic Museum.
Jessica says that distinction is important because it reinforces the identity aspect that she considers crucial.
When you say Hispanic to me, it's like, yes, I know that I have ancestors or, you know, los descendientes from Spain. I get it. But then Latin America is in its own self rich, and we identify ourselves as Latinos and Latinas. I'm not claiming that I'm coming from Spain. I'm claiming that I'm coming from Latin America.
Coming from Latin America, though, can mean coming from drastically different countries with different histories and cultures. Fitting them all under one roof is a tall order. But Ross Leighton is confident everyone will be reflected in the museum. And she has some specific ideas for what she hopes to find inside.
We're very excited about having a Celia Cruz exhibit. She was an international star. One of her last hits was Life is a Carnival. Boy, what a great hit that was. And I know we're going to have a great food court, because who does not like Latino food? I think it's going to be the best food court in Washington.
It's a short bus ride from Jessica's school to the National Mall, where the museum will likely sit, making it a perfect field trip destination.
I'm just excited to see the kids' faces when they see the history and when they learn about the history.
History, she hopes, that will be expansive.
We read about Sonia Sotomayor, you know, but who else is out there? I'm sure there's many more.
Jessica notes that it can't fall on one institution to capture the full scope of the American Latino. She hopes this new space will inspire museums and educators across the country to invest in telling Latino stories. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
A quick thanks to you for spending part of your day with us. In case you'd like a little more of The World, here's another way we can connect. Start your morning with a hit of news stories from around the globe. Just sign up for our morning newsletter, Top of the World, on our website, theworld.org/newsletters, and we will get your day started right. Again, that's theworld.org/newsletters. You're with The World. Taiwan has done really well in its battle against the coronavirus. A lot of credit goes to Taiwan's digital minister, who brings an unconventional approach to innovative policy.
Well, I think I'm more of a poetician, meaning that I'm just writing some poetry.
Not just. Ancient philosophy meets modern technology in Taiwan. That's still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of WGBH Boston and PRX. If you're Alexander Lukashenko, president of Belarus for 26 years, and you're insisting you won last week's election, the reaction from your country has not been good. Today in Belarus, Lukashenko went to speak to workers at a tractor factory in the capital, Minsk. They heckled the president, shouting, "Leave and resign." Many Belarusians are furious with what they say was a fraudulent election just over a week ago. Lukashenko is rejecting calls for a new vote. He's also looking to the Kremlin and Russian leader Vladimir Putin for support. Analyst Konstantin Eggert has been watching the situation closely and joins us from Vilnius, the capital of neighboring Lithuania. Some have said Lukashenko is facing what looks like the tumultuous last days of dictator Nicolae Ceausescu in Romania in 1989. I asked Konstantin Eggert what he thought.
To some extent, these are the final days of Lukashenko, but the end may not be as dramatic and tragic to some extent as Ceausescu's was. I think that Lukashenko is starting to play for time. He implicitly suggested to go by saying, let us adopt a new constitution and then I will go. This is already the beginning of a tentative negotiation with the opposition. His advantage is that there is no clear-cut leader among the opposition, no Václav Havel or Lech Walesa or Boris Yeltsin in Belarus. Because of that, the protest was fairly successful because it was a mass protest. But on the other hand, in politics, you really need focus. And Lukashenko, I think, starts to prepare his way out, but he wants it to be as extended and as secure as possible.
That's Lukashenko's view, but it is clear to you, though, that Svetlana Tikhanovskaya is the fully supported opposition candidate.
She is, but she promised to stay on as president for 6 months just to organize new elections. And this is the promise she will probably have to keep. It leaves a huge field of maneuver for Mr. Putin to try and keep Belarus in Russia's orbit. He has enough money and enough pro-Russian feeling in Belarus to play with the presidential candidates' field, to pump in resources, to pump in PR advisors, to give economic perks, to ensure that Belarus stays within Russian orbit, doesn't want to join the EU, doesn't want to move west generally. And this is Mr. Putin's main goal from now. I do think that he probably has given up on Mr. Lukashenko, although, on the other hand, he doesn't want him to perish like Nikolai Ceausescu, because that will set a very, very dangerous precedent for Russia proper. In Russia, people are looking towards Belarus. It is essentially a very short drive from Moscow. It's a 25-minute flight. And this is Russia's westernmost outpost. Also, his own entourage, the Russian political elites, the Russian political class, will look at him and say, well, you can't hold Belarus.
Today, Lukashenko is rejecting new elections, but he also says he's willing to share power and change the constitution, but not under pressure from protesters. What is his strategy? I mean, is there an opening here for Svetlana Tikhanovskaya to return from exile and lead side by side with Lukashenko? I mean, would she even do that?
I think that she will come back from Vilnius, where she's now, and she's, by the way, not talking to the press deliberately. And I think that she will be part of the process. But there's going to be huge Russian interference in these elections, because to lose Belarus to the West, to the EU and to NATO, is something that Mr. Putin cannot even contemplate.
So when you say interference in the Belarusian elections, are you talking about after the election and Putin coming to the aid of President Lukashenko, or are you talking about actual like meddling in the elections?
No, I think that Putin's written off Lukashenko. He, I think, should understand by now he won't survive. What he doesn't want for Lukashenko is a kind of Muammar Gaddafi end, because he doesn't want Belarus to set an example, to set precedent for Russia, where Mr. Putin's been in power for 20 years. So in a certain way, I would say that the battle for Belarus is only beginning.
Analyst Konstantin Egert in Vilnius, the Lithuanian capital. Thank you so much for your time.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Most government ministers are not well-versed in software programming, Star Trek, and Taoist philosophy. Audrey Tang is. She's Taiwan's digital minister. And perhaps it's because she has that multifaceted mind that she's been able to reshape ideas about what government officials can do. At age 35, she became Taiwan's youngest minister ever. She's also the first openly transgender member of a Taiwanese cabinet. Now Audrey Tang is helping Taiwan navigate the coronavirus through civic technology. COVID-19 numbers are exceedingly low in Taiwan. They've had fewer than 500 cases and only 7 deaths. Audrey Tang joined me from Taipei and began by explaining how Taiwan has used technology to help manage the virus.
Well, the most important technology is, of course, soap and alcohol hand sanitizers. But in Taiwan, we see democracy itself as a technology, and the counter-pandemic effort is mostly about getting people understanding the science, the epidemiology, so that people can innovate and wash their hands more vigorously, wear a mask, and making sure that each pharmacies have sufficient supply. And, of course, there's also the border quarantine.
The border, explain that?
Yeah, the border quarantine. Anyone returning to Taiwan have two choices. Either they go to a quarantine hotel for 14 days, in which case they're physically barred from leaving, or if they live in a place with their own bathroom and with no vulnerable group of people, they can also choose to digitally quarantine, placing their phone into the digital fence, in which case the nearby cell phone tower will measure the signal strength, as they always do, and send a SMS whenever the phone runs out of battery or breaks out of the 50 meter or so radius. So the idea is that during the 14 days, we pay each person in quarantine about $33 a day as a stipend. But if they break out of the quarantine, then they pay us back 1,000 times that. So very few people broke the quarantine.
So, Audrey, you mentioned masks. Masks have been in high demand in Taiwan. They've been in high demand everywhere. Technology kind of came to the rescue for kind of democratizing access to masks. Tell us what happened.
There was a person named Howard Wu in Tainan City who developed a map so that people can see the nearby places and exactly how many masks there are in stock. So we very quickly supplied every 30 seconds the real-time mask levels of all the pharmacies and later on convenience stores so that people who queue in line can keep this system accountable.
Right. And it's not just with COVID, I understand. Even before you were appointed, Taiwan had a history of using technology to, I guess, really listen to and support its citizens. I mean, can you walk us through what that looks like?
Yeah, definitely. So one of the most popular maps that shows the mask availability has been modified from the Airbox map. And the Airbox is a inexpensive measuring device to measure the air quality. And so many primary school teachers, people who volunteer their balcony and so on, join in this data collaborative effort to make sure that we can map out the air quality together. Eventually helped people to measure the not only air quality now, but also water quality, earthquake prevention, advanced SMS warning and disaster relief and things like that in a crowdsourced way. And by crowdsourcing, I mean that people become data producers, not just, you know, media literacy as in consumers of data, but rather media competency as producers of data.
What do you think can go wrong with crowdsourcing? I mean, what's the downside to it?
A couple of things. First, if we design crowdsourcing so that it replaces face-to-face deliberation, then it runs the very real risk of excluding people who are suffering the most, closest to the pain. So that's why our crowdsourcing is always in augmentation of face-to-face consultations. That's the first thing. And the second thing is about equality. In Taiwan, broadband is a human right. Even on the tip of Taiwan, almost 4,000 meters high, people still have 10 megabits per second as just $16 per month. No additional cost, unlimited data. Otherwise, it's my fault. And so that we will not systemically exclude people who don't have broadband.
So, Audrey Tang, when I think about this intersection specifically of public health and technology, like philosophically, what would you say is Taiwan's motivation?
Well, I used to tweet that in democratic Taiwan, ministers trust you. And radically trusting the citizens, I think, is the main philosophy, because we're a very young democracy, having the direct presidential election only in 1996. We see democracy itself as a set of technologies that we can tweak and improve. So that's not just about a few people talking to millions of people, but rather listening to millions of people and with one another.
I'm speaking with Audrey Tang, who is Taiwan's digital minister. Audrey, my head is spinning with the innovation and creativity you're talking about here. How much of the spirit in Taiwan, and don't be humble, how much of the spirit in Taiwan is kind of credited to you?
Well, I think very few of them is my idea. I guess the journalists, especially foreign journalists, really do credit a lot to me, maybe because I run a pretty good Twitter account. But I still think that I'm merely amplifying the people's best ideas. I'm here so that people can place the trust into a well-earned trustworthiness institution. That is to say, when people coming up with a social innovation, regardless of whether it's, for example, using traditional rice cooker can disinfect a mask, or that they think that a CCC medical officer should wear pink medical mask to support boys who don't want to go to school because all they have is pink medical mask, and they actually did. And all this, I think, is just those great ideas. And I'm merely someone who maintains the operating system so that this institution can respond in more agile fashion.
So let me get that straight. You can sterilize a medical mask in a rice cooker?
Yeah, in traditional rice cooker. That's exactly right. See my Twitter for how.
Wow. Okay. You've got a really compelling life story, Audrey. You were the youngest person ever appointed to a cabinet position in Taiwan at the age of 35. Did you think of yourself as a political person when you first started out in tech?
Well, I think I'm more of a poetician, meaning that I'm just writing some poetry, making sure that people understand the philosophical underpinnings of modern technology. So, for example, instead of Internet of Things, I talk about Internet of Beings. Instead of machine learning, I talk about collaborative learning. Instead of singularity, I talk about plurality and so on. And that's really my main work in the free software community and now in the, I guess, liberal democratic community.
So calling yourself a poetician, not surprised to know that you're also pretty in tune with meditation, Taoism specifically. How do you think that helps you as a member of government?
One of the central tenets of Taoism is this Wei Wu Wei, do not doing. So when we in the government try to do something, we kind of limit the public sector's imaginations. And when the career public servants are deprived of the freedom to innovate because the high-level politicians think they know the best, that we lose a very important ally in connecting with the public. And so Wei Wu Wei, literally do not doing, I think is the most important thing.
Audrey Tang, I understand you're a big fan of Leonard Cohen. Do you have a song quote from the late Mr. Cohen for this moment where, you know, trust is the cement that keeps it all together?
Sure. So it comes from the song Anthem. Let's ring the bells that still can ring. Forget our perfect offering. There is a crack in everything. And that's how the light gets in.
Yeah, that's a good one. Audrey Tang is the digital minister of Taiwan. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, and live long and prosper.
Flu season is just around the corner for the Northern Hemisphere. Health leaders are sounding the alarm about the double whammy of flu and COVID-19. The World's Alana Gordon covers global health for the show and has been looking into this. First of all, Alana, remind us, how is seasonal flu different from what we know about the coronavirus?
So seasonal flu, not to sound too redundant, it's seasonal. So in the Northern Hemisphere, like in the U.S., the flu gets going in the fall, and then it really picks up in the winter months. People also tend to be indoors during that time, together in groups. So that's the flu. With coronavirus, it's a more severe virus, and it's not following seasonal patterns right now. It hasn't calmed down during warmer months. And one other big difference is with this new coronavirus, not to sound redundant, but it's completely new to us, so everyone could get it. Whereas with the flu, it does come around every year, so some of our bodies have a bit of familiarity with it.
I am guessing this is a very worrying spot to be in, as places like the United States, which is still not getting the coronavirus under control, is also heading now into this flu season.
In the U.S., the CDC's director, Robert Redfield, he's been quoted as saying that this could be the worst fall from a public health perspective we've ever seen from COVID-19 and then flu. Because again, if you think about it, you've got a potentially deadly new virus coinciding with the seasonal respiratory illness, sometimes showing similar symptoms. You've got a healthcare system with limited resources and tests. And there's also a big concern, again, that with coronavirus, it could thrive more in the winter, as viruses tend to do. So there's some modeling that is anticipating even more pronounced outbreaks of coronavirus and even bigger surges.
So the Southern Hemisphere, they're in their winter now. They're already in flu season. What are we seeing there with flu and coronavirus together?
Well, this is where it gets kind of interesting. Places like Australia, South Africa are already in the thick of flu season right now. I talked with Cecile Vibou, who's been monitoring flu for decades. She's an epidemiologist with the Fogarty International Center at the National Institutes of Health. And Marco, get this.
There's very, very little respiratory viruses except for COVID-19.
In other words, flu activity right now in the Southern Hemisphere is unusually low.
What is behind that? Is there an explanation?
So Vibou and others have some strong ideas. If you think about it, the ways we've changed our behavior during the pandemic make it harder for the flu to spread too. So we have social distancing, people are wearing masks, washing hands. Also, the flu has to hitch a ride to spread from place to place, and there's just less travel right now because of the pandemic. Finally, there's this theory. It happens with other viruses, and it's this thing called viral interference.
Explain that. What is viral interference?
So it's essentially this phenomenon where one virus tends to dominate. And in doing so, it basically buffers other viruses from taking hold. One flu scientist, John Paget, at the Nivelle Research Institute in Holland, described it to me as it being kind of like a dance. So at some point, the other virus might step in and have its turn.
That's really fascinating. But I mean, the coronavirus is dominating the Southern Hemisphere right now. And the fact that the flu is not so bad right now, I mean, can we see that as a bit of good news?
I mean, public health leaders are definitely worried about two epidemics at once. And we don't know about the impact of things like co-infection. For flu, there's a vaccine, so there's an increased emphasis on how important that is to get that right now. Vibhu, though, is cautiously optimistic based on what she's seeing in the South when it comes to the flu itself. But at the same time, she says that coronavirus, it's uncharted territory. And so she warns that that kind of prediction is only that.
What we've learned over many years is that flu always surprises us. I mean, the virus evolves. So, you know, there's always a part that's unpredictable.
Yeah, expect surprises and be careful making predictions. I guess that's good advice all through this pandemic. The World's Elana Gordon, thanks very much for this.
Thank you.
Some major news from the UN. On Friday, the U.S. has handed a defeat by the UN Security Council. The Council rejected a proposal from the U.S. that would extend a conventional arms embargo on Iran. Only one country sided with the U.S., that's the Dominican Republic. Major allies of the U.S., like the U.K. and Germany, abstained. Let's recall that 15 nations sit on the Security Council, a mix of permanent and non-permanent members. In the wake of defeat, the U.S. is now threatening to take even more drastic measures, and it could prompt a diplomatic showdown with the Security Council. Azadeh Zamirirad is an Iran analyst at the German Institute for International and Security Affairs in Berlin. Azadeh, Friday's UN Security Council vote, it's a repudiation of the U.S. proposal. Did it come as a surprise to you?
It didn't really come as a surprise. I mean, the rejection was basically expected by nearly everyone, including the United States, and was actually part of a two-step approach of killing the nuclear deal once and for all. The U.S. administration knew that Russia and China would veto it and wanted to move on from there to trigger the snapback mechanism. But they might not have anticipated such a clear defeat. I think the U.S. did not really manage to convince even smaller member states to vote in their favor. And the fact that they only got one other vote was a diplomatic embarrassment that was not expected and that they certainly would have liked to avoid.
So now, as you kind of alluded to there, the U.S. is threatening to trigger a return of all sanctions lifted as part of the JCPOA, the nuclear deal negotiated under President Obama. To do this, the U.S. is saying they can use a mechanism in the deal itself. You referred to it there, the snapback. How does the snapback work, and can the U.S. actually do this if it's already pulled out of the deal?
Well, snapback can actually only be triggered by a JCPOA participant state. And the U.S. claims it is still a participant state, even though it left the deal behind more than 2 years ago and has repeatedly actually stated in the past that they are no longer part of the agreement. And since then, the administration has tried everything to undermine the deal and prevent other member states from upholding their obligations. So I don't think the U.S. is in any position to make any legalistic arguments here.
What would be the reaction on the Security Council if the U.S. were to follow through on this threat?
They do have several options. I mean, member states could try to block the U.S. from putting the issue on the agenda of the United Nations so that the U.S. administration cannot actually notify the Security Council. They could try to delay the process over and over again, but it is uncertain whether this would be successful. Russia suggested a P5 summit together with other parties of the nuclear agreement, including Germany and Iran. But there doesn't seem to be much appetite in the U.S. administration to actually prevent a crisis in the Security Council. And they seem to have exhausted all their means with the maximum pressure policy and didn't expect Iran to still stay in the deal. And apparently now they cannot really find a face-saving way to get out of this mess.
So where we're at now, could this effectively freeze the U.S. out of the Security Council? I mean, what would be the lasting impact on the Council?
Well, I wouldn't say freeze out of it, but it has certainly harmed, I think, U.S. standing also diplomatically on the international arena. The U.S. administration has shown its disregard for multilateralism and diplomacy, particularly with regard to Iran, again and again, and has managed to vastly isolate itself through that approach. It has even managed to alienate its own allies, even though they actually share U.S. concerns regarding Iran's nuclear program or its regional policies and many other Iran-related issues. But transatlantic cooperation on Iran has become virtually impossible under Trump. And the U.S. could have cooperated more closely with other nations, including its allies, but it actually chose not to. So this is the result of it.
So at this point, what do you think is the future of the Iran nuclear deal negotiated under President Obama, the JCPOA?
I think this deal can still be saved. If we manage to get through this snapback crisis in the Security Council, if there's a strong international response by simply ignoring snapback, if the U.S. is to push through, then we might convince Iran to give it a little bit more time to wait for changed political conditions. And then everything is open. Then things can get renegotiated, added, talked about, including other issues, not just the nuclear issues. And that would be possible under a Biden administration, even though that wouldn't be easy. But things will get far more complicated if Trump is in fact reelected. And of course, if Iran and the Iranian leadership cannot withhold this kind of domestic pressure that they're under, and if they then decide to leave things behind way sooner than the U.S. elections.
Azadeh Zamirirod is an Iran analyst at the German Institute for International and Security Affairs. She's been speaking with us from Berlin. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Tomorrow on the show, the production of masks, gloves, and protective equipment is an industry that's exploded in China. Cameron Johnson is literally on the ground floor doing quality control inside Chinese factories.
You know, we've had conversations with people who say, you know, we need 300 million boxes of gloves and we need it in 2 weeks.
And getting those gloves, it's still complicated, even 8 months into the pandemic. Johnson's advice? Hedge your bets.
What companies and organizations need to look at is whatever they think they need to essentially order double.
Join us for that story from Shanghai tomorrow here on The World. Getting back to one of our top stories today, the continuing protests across Belarus, demanding the country's president step down after widespread charges of fraud in the August 9th vote there. Protesters are basically saying enough is enough. They want change, and they've turned to a Soviet-era rock band for the current Belarusian protest anthem. Demonstrators in Belarus playing their version of the song I Want Change on bagpipes and acoustic guitars. Instruments aside, they are feeling the original new wave energy of the tune. The song itself is the work of Kino, the most influential rock band in Soviet history. It was in 1987, as the dissolution of the Soviet Union grew more inevitable with each passing day, that Kino and their talented songwriter Viktor Tsoi performed on TV in the USSR their song Kochu Pomenin, or I Want Change. To the great sadness of his many fans across the USSR, Viktor Tsoi died in a car crash in 1990. Kino broke up not long after, but today the band's legacy is healthy in the streets of Belarus. Legendary Soviet rockers Kino there with an old song for new protests in Belarus. From the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. Thanks for being with us. We'll see you back here tomorrow.